On the behalf of the Marshall Economic Society and the Geography Society, I would like to welcome Danny Morling. He is the author of Inequality and the 1% and also a professor at Oxford University. So as I'm sure we all know, the UK has one of the highest rates of income inequality in Europe, and this has been a contributing factor to the Brexit referendum. With the negotiations deadline looming, what will Brexit bring? So without any further ado, I would like to welcome Danny to speak about this very relevant topical issue. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you for humouring me about the music. That's a video we put together yesterday. It's the first time we've shown it in public. If any of you could be kind enough, at the very end, if you think any of the images or anything was inappropriate, if you could come down and quietly tell us before we show it at 50 other venues during 2019, as me and Sally Thomas and my colleague around the country talking about Brexit, because people are interested in Brexit. Inequality of the 1% was a book I did a few years ago. At the point when the 1% were taking more than the 1% are anywhere else in Europe. And at that time it felt important to say this was a problem because there were still a large number of people in this country who thought it's okay if the best off 1% take a sixth of all income as long as they're generating wealth. I don't know, I'm in an economic society, so maybe somebody will argue that that's still okay, but I don't hear people anymore saying that's okay. I think since Brexit, it wasn't just a crash that changed things, it was the shock of June 2016. I'm unbiased because I've worked in inequality for 20 years, think that underlying why we're the first country after Greenland to leave the European Community, underlying that is not high rates of immigration or an inherent sense that we have a special kind of solitude we should regain. I think underlying it, in hindsight, was that things were falling apart for many people, not for most people. And falling apart in parts of the country you wouldn't expect. And that is, in particular, where I think the media have got the story wrong. The media loves to talk about Sunderland and Middlesbrough and Great Yarmouth and Stoke, but that's not the places that mattered. There aren't enough people living there. It was Hampshire, Gloucestershire, Dorset. If you want to know who voted out, this is where the millions of people were. Free markets are often inefficient. We have done a huge service in the world in the UK, even a bigger service in the USA, helping to demonstrate the inefficiency of free markets. If you want an example, you're going to get one because you're going to be trying to house yourselves in the next 10 years. There is nothing more inefficient than leaving housing up to the market in terms of how you allocate housing in the country. If you decide that you don't like having a part of the housing supply which is coordinated by government, that you want to get social housing down and down as small as you can, that you want to get private renting up because it's efficient, that you want people to be homeowners because that's efficient, you end up with a country full of empty bedrooms, full of old people hanging on in there in housing waiting until they die so they can give money to their children. Young professionals renting former council houses that used to house four people on their own. It's only one of you. You'll be renting a council flat in London in 5 years' time, thinking this is a really quality flat I'm in. And then before there was a family of four living there. I can go on and on. I think theoretically you could have said back in the 1970s and 80s, my equations show that leaving things to the market is the best you could do. The nice thing is we've run the experiment, we know it's wrong. Brexit, more Brexit. I'm afraid you're going to get a lot of Brexit, but I do promise to finish in less than 45 minutes. These are the sections of the talk you're going to get. First of all, we're going to talk a bit about immigration, immigration history in Britain, how immigration has been used to scare people at various times, why some people choose to use immigration to scare people. I'm then going to make the the claim that hostility to the European Union isn't something that was slowly growing steadily in Britain. In hindsight, it was something that had been whipped up at each European election by, it turns out, a group of affluent men who really wanted people to hate the European Union, one of whom has been the first national crime agency recently, making these arguments somewhat easier to make. Thirdly, the geography of the Brexit vote has been remarkably distorted. This shows how bad we are with geography and how bad geographers are at explaining things. The story that you're told of who voted Leave is not the true story of who voted Leave, and the data's there for anybody who wants to look. So why aren't the media saying it's actually the majority of Leave votes were in the south of England, the majority of Leave votes were social class ABC1? Why are they not saying this? It's because it's the parents of people who work in WNA. And it's quite hard, it's your grandparents, it's their parents. It's quite hard to blame your own parents for this. It's much easier to blame people you've never met in an industrialised small northern town, in the state of England, all Wales. Wales is the greatest libel, because of all the countries and regions of the UK, can you guess which one voted as near to the UK average? It was Wales. And we label Wales as voting inexplicitly out. Wales just did the average vote for the UK. And why did Wales vote Leave? Who was it? It was the Old in Wales. Which group are the Old in Wales, which is the largest group of immigrants in Britain, who have disrupted local communities, who buy the houses and you can't live there, who don't even learn to speak the bloody language. It's the English in Wales who disproportionately voted Leave in Wales. See, I'm a geographer, so I won't go on about this endlessly, but the misrepresentation of that vote, in a way that is, it's not a matter of opinion, this is just adding up numbers by areas and showing them. Inequality affects your lives in ways that you're not even aware of. For instance, you probably think you're pretty clever. You've been given exam results all your life, telling you you're very clever. You turn up here, and I don't know whether it's the same as where I work. Where I work, if you turn up on your first day in a place like this, they say, don't feel bad, don't worry that you're inadequate, you're really good, in fact, you're the premier, you're the best of the best. The good news, if you're thinking, oh Christ, you know, I'm not that clever, is you're the best of the best in a very unequal country that produces less able people at the top than more equal countries do. So you're not as clever as clever Germans, or clever Swedes, or clever Japanese. And that's you. I'm not talking about people at the bottom or the average, the clever folk in England are not as clever as well. Empire. Less affects your age range, but if you want one thing to explain why did the old folk out, it wasn't selfishly for them. They know they're going to die soon. They're not that stupid. They voted out for you. And they voted out for you because they wanted you to have what they had. And what they had, what I had, I'm old. The first time I went to France when I was age 15, I got 10 francs for every pound I had. I was a king. Imagine how much wine you can buy as a 15-year-old boy if for every pound you have you get 10 francs. Britain was the richest country in the world 100 years ago. The old have watched that collapse. In hindsight, I think 52-48 is a perfect result. Because suppose it had been 60% Remain, 40% Leave. Would there be any investigations into the Leave vote? Would anybody have wondered where the 8 million came from? What would have happened if Remain had won by 60%? Would the Brexiteers have gone away? Or would we be looking at a second referendum? Would everything that had gone wrong in this country since that referendum, if Remain had won it, be blamed on the fact that the elite tricked the British people into voting Remain? Do you see what I'm saying, if you imagine it? And if you go this way, if you imagine that Leave had won 60 or 70%, we'd be straight at hard Brexit, we wouldn't do negotiations or anything else, we'd be out of there. And I personally think that would be fairly disastrous. if you can remember the look on Boris Johnson and Michael Gove's face when they won, because they didn't want to win, they didn't mean to win, because they had no plan for winning. That was the look of, oh shit, this is the worst possible thing that can happen, and we're going to take the blame for this, and we haven't planned. We wanted to be the champions of the people, cruelly mobbed by the BBC, the CPI, trade unions, and all those other traitors. And both of them, of course, wanted to be Prime Minister. I'm going to go through graphs very, very quickly to stay on time with you, because you're used to graphs, aren't you? I don't often get to talk to an audience, but I never get to talk to an audience who are used to graphs. There's two time series shown here. One is the net immigration rate. This country, for the last 150 years, has actually been a net emigration country most of the time. When I was your age in the 1980s, we were losing people. In the 1990s recession, we actually lost people. And of course, most of the empire years, we were sending people all over the empire. Net immigration is a relatively rare thing, the recent thing. When net immigration rises, immigration rises up the political agenda as the most salient political issue. In fact, it takes the biggest economic crash since 1929 to knock immigration off the top spot. I used to go to election conferences, and quietly there with political scientists, we'd all say, oh, Christ, look at that. You know, immigration is the most salient issue that people really care about the most. Let's not talk about that because we're nice little academics. Let's look at their options 2, 3, and 4. Why? Why did people think immigration was so bad? Because they were told it was bad. They were told that the reason that your child's school is mediocre is that the immigrants are getting their children to the better school. They were told that the reason that you can't get a house off the waiting list or the fact that houses cost so much is because of the immigrants coming and raising house prices. They were told that it was immigrants coming here that were reducing the wages of jobs. It is relatively easy to increase the wages of jobs. You simply decide you want to do that. We have 27 other countries we can look at to see ways in which you get the income ratio narrow, including countries with higher rates of immigration than we've had. But immigrants were an ever so easy scapegoat. And if you were a political party who were in favour of inequality, which is what the Conservative Party have been, essentially a party of inequality, let top talent rise to the top, it will generate wealth, you want to keep useless people down and just be feckless. If that's your basic, most fundamental reason to be a political party, you can't tell the population that. Because if you tell people we think most of you are pretty useless, we would like you to vote for us, they won't do it. If you tell them we'll look after you and we'll control those immigrants from swarming or swamping or whatever word you use, you'll get more votes. Promise to keep the house prices high, you get even more votes. Here's the kind of graph that if we were in the USA, you would see very frequently, which we don't see at all here because we do not celebrate our immigrant history. This is data from each census from 1841, which I think when we first asked people when they were born, right up to 2011. Just showing you some of the countries, and I've just highlighted particular points for acceleration. And I won't be flippant about it. I can talk about how terrible it was when all those Jews came over us, you know, just over a century ago, how that met Britain. Not only they produced all those bloody Nobel Peace Prize scientists who worked at Cambridge afterwards, but I won't. And of course, nobody now talks about how terrible it was that the Windrush generation arrived after Enoch Powell invited them in. But they still talk about the terrible disruptive effect of all the Eastern Europeans who turned up in places mostly which voted for May because they were so happy that the Eastern Europeans turned up. People don't migrate to areas that don't need people. That's one way of looking at that data. Here's the other way. Right? And it's not that high in terms of the European context. Most of the UK sees hardly any immigrants. I was on Radio Doncaster on the day when the last pit around Doncaster closed, And we just published an Atlas of Britain showing which was the biggest immigrant group in each area. And the radio producer, after having read out that the last pit had closed, turned to me and said, "So who are all these bloody Germans then?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, our biggest immigrant group in Doncaster is Germans. So I want to know why they're coming over here and what they're doing." And I couldn't work out how to say to him, so I didn't. They are people born in Germany, but they were born to soldiers of the Army of the Rhine, British soldiers, out in Germany when we sent British soldiers to Germany, and they're back, and because they're English, because they're the children of squaddies, that's your biggest immigrant group. Because at that time, nobody wanted to come to Doncaster. Now, because essentially Doncaster, when the industry went, was essentially cannon fodder. And so we could recruit into the British Army easily from Doncaster. And I couldn't say it because they just announced the last pit had gone. But he was angry about these Germans that he'd only just learnt about because of some Atlas I produced. You are living in an immigrant city. You are, of course, immigrants. You're internal immigrants, mostly. Who's born in Cambridge? Just check. Hey, what's it feel like? You know, I was born in Oxford. Sometimes I do get a bit nostalgic because almost everybody who went to my school was Natalie Edison. You know, if you want to talk about an area completely decimated by immigration, Oxford, Cambridge, Central London. Of course, there aren't enough people left to get angry. A quick map, this is a map of 16 to 24 year olds, a mass census, coloured in by some of the most common ethnicities. The point of the map is just to show you, most of it's blue. In blue areas, the most common ethnicity has been white or some other kind of white, and that's young people. Right? This is not a particularly diverse country. And the areas which are largely white or whatever kind of white are largely areas that were more likely to vote leave. I highlighted Stoke because I gave this talk in Stoke a few weeks ago. This is the opposite kind of place for Cambridge. You know, this is Remain Central. Stoke is very leaf. This is a map of immigration a couple of years before the Brexit vote. And the maps are stretched. So, who got an A at Maths A level or above? Go on. Who got a B at Maths A level? Who's doing the economics degree without Maths A level? How many of you have lied and got to put your hands up? Okay. Anyway, you're fairly good at maths. We stretched the map. Areas of population. Everybody's looking at mountains and sheep. That's normal maps are useless. The areas that are coloured dark blue, darkest blue, 20% of the population were born in another country. The areas that are coloured in light is yellow, less than 5%, hardly any immigrants. Eastern Europe, largely yellow, hardly any immigrants. Northern England is like Eastern Europe. Not because there are people from Eastern Europe there, they're not, really. You can find a few around Boston, and a tiny bit in Sheffield, but honestly, why the hell would you turn up to a town with no work if you just come all the way from Poland? Right? You come to Oxford. You know, just placing somebody else who was born in Oxford. The dark blue in Britain is just part of London. It's part of West London, this high immigration area. Compared to Ireland, Ireland has a high proportion of immigrants because quite a lot of people were born on one side of that none border. Brexit has done wonderful things for us. The British didn't realise that there isn't a border there. You sign an agreement on Good Friday. You put a yogurt pot on that line and you're in trouble. One reason you're in trouble, apart from one of the worst internal civil wars in European recent history, which really didn't matter, is all the dark blue. Because people moved over that border and were born. Anyway, the big blob in France is Paris, if you're trying to get your head around this. The big blob in, two big blobs in Spain are Barcelona and Madrid. And that dark area by the coast of blues in Spain is full of immigrants. And guess who the biggest group is? And you're going to meet them soon. You only meet the ones who fall in. I don't know, who's got a black hair when they've gone to Costa del Sol? Couple of you. It's like the English people. As of the 29th of March, no more healthcare. So the ill ones will come back. Just what we need. But of course, you know, we were bringing in all these elderly European people coming here. This is the most healthy, best educated, hardest working, most easy to rip off, cheapest workforce ever that we don't want. They logged them into Switzerland. Much higher rates of immigration in Switzerland. Sometimes causes some upset. Occasionally they have a referendum, they say, oh, we're going to stop the immigrants. And then when they do that, they have another one to say, oh, no, you can come back in again. If you're in favour of repeated referendum, I'm generally against referendums. There is an argument of having lots. The problem with having lots, that the Swiss will tell you, is that the old always vote in referendums. So you've always got to go and vote too, to stop the old getting what they want. If you want to vote, it's fine. Anyway, the point of this is just to say, where's the bloody? Where's the unusual? The UK should all be dark blue if this terrible, unusual thing happened. We opened up early to AA migration, which just meant we get the most get-up-and-go, able, fit, best electricians and plumbers and shop fitters and caterers, and I don't know if it's like Oxford, but who serves your food here? How do you eat? Who's keeping this city clean? I hope you're looking forward to doing some of that yourself after March 29th. Just one day a week, say. You can study the best of it, but... these two graphs, these two lines in this graph are the poll results for support for remaining leave over the months and years up to the referendum. You can see when lucky day, 40 be lucky, the side is going to call the referendum, 40 win it. You can see how nearly it came, the point is it flips. This is not steady. This opinion on this thing goes up and down. It was being influenced by things, by events. This graph is unusual. Well, I think it is. You may get this in economics, I don't know. This is a graph, it's a phase space diagram for maths. All it's showing is the height on the y-axis is the support for far right parties. Or I should say far, far right parties. UKIP, BNP, National Front, Referendum. Okay? Those parties. Which got up to a peak of about 14% in 2012. The y-axis is the speed of the change in that popularity. So they've got a big loop out, 2012, 2014. There's really big acceleration in support for UKIP and a few other minor fascist parties at just the right time. I won't bore you with the referendum party and Jimmy's goals of it back in 1997. This has been a long time coming. The point of showing you this diagram is that you can see the peak just before every European election. So what happened? The population in Britain suddenly decided to read Encyclopedia Britannica and later Wikipedia and educate itself about Europe, and before each election decided to get increasingly anti-European, or did they read the Daily Mail? Right? And you can kind of guess what happened. It's not a slow and steady rise in anti-European sentiment. It is a whipped up thing in hindsight. This is truly remarkable though. This little graph here near me is every European election we've had since 1979. The proportion of people who voted, just voters, remember sometimes only a third vote, the proportion of people who voted in European elections who voted for a party to the right of mainstream European politics, what most people would call far right. There was a big EPP bloc in Europe, that is European Conservatives. If you're not in the European Conservatives, you are far right. Also, that's what the rest of Europe determines as their far right parties, when we're talking about Hungary and Poland and the Front National in France. Way back in 79, 84, and I can remember National Front in 79, they didn't even put up candidates. Less than 1,000 people voted far right in European elections in the 70s and the 80s. By the time we get to 1999, 7.5% voting far right. 2004, about a fifth of the population voting far right in this country. Of all those who voted. 2009, gets up to 37%, and I've included half the Conservative vote, because the Conservatives left the EPP at that point, they didn't know where they were. 2014, and I, you know, people out there kicking ourselves, if I just written this in 2014, but I didn't recognise it, I didn't see it. In 2014, 52.4% of people who voted in European elections voted for a party to the right of mainstream Conservatives, voted far right in this country. We are the far right capital of Europe. We don't think we are. We think our country of Conservatives are a country of Conservatives. You know, it's used to them. It's got a little bit more vague, but there still are Tories. But they left normal Conservatives. They started making alliances with people like the Free Finns and AFD and so on. If you look at our MEPs, huge block of UKIP MEPs, Nigel Farage and Co, huge block of Tory MEPs. It makes me glad we're leaving, to be honest. It makes me glad. I would much rather stay in Europe. I have to say a lot of things, but I would be very glad for a time to send any more members of the European Parliament to Brussels, because we've been sending the biggest bunch of obnoxious people over there. And it doesn't make things easy. And it allows the European far right to organise. And the European far right organises around British MEPs, gets them funding, allows them to be a block in the parliament. We don't think of our country as far right. We talk about Hungary as far right. We talk about Austria. We did it. That's why we're going through this. Here's the vote. The actual map of the vote. It's not like any other map. Fascinating, it's London, who's most remain. You can see Cambridge just above London, you can see my little spot of Oxford, you can see some unusual things. We didn't realise how possible to Manchester was and Liverpool was, and we can see Bristol, but most of the country is blue. Or the country being England. There's the best estimates by age. So there was a getting out of bed problem. The great news is that the getting out of bed problem was learned, and I'll show you later about the 2017 general election. The getting out of bed problem began in 1992 with the poll tax, which was an amazing good incentive not to register yourself to vote. And you can work out that better. The one nearer me, I think, is much more interesting. It's partly trying to explain, you know, what do the old think we've lost? It's the dollar to the pound ratio in the 20th century. It goes back to what I was saying about getting French francs when I was a child. 35 years ago, 10 to 1, I was at Gatwick a few weeks ago, £1.11 for a euro. That's a gadget. I know it's not that you should buy your euros, but still. And what do you think? Do a poll later. Where are you going to put the pound on? Say just 12 months from now. Barclays shares are at half what they were for the referendum. Lloyds were a third. They have no passports. And we're very British. And, you know, between these four walls, they'll tell each other this, but let's keep calm and carry on. This is one of the most amazing graphics produced by a young unemployed lad in Newcastle in his own bedroom. He divided all the parliamentary constituencies of England up into 10 groups. The 10th of constituencies with the least deprivation, which are the ones nearest to me, and the slightly taller because identified exactly as 10, down to the most deprived 10th. And the red areas are the constituencies that voted the strongest to leave. Now, you and I live in, let's say, this is Cambridge, this is Oxford, this is London, this is one skiing holiday or two skiing holidays this year, that's the question. And, you know, we don't want anything holding up getting our skis onto the slopes, so we really have the idea of Brexit. But if you look in the middle of that graph, in decile 4, 5, 6, that's Middle England, not the poorest parts, that's the most solidly lead, just for that. Here's the graph showing that Wales is the most average. And the key thing is turnout. Yes, people in the Sunderland might have voted to leave, but a bigger group of people in the Sunderland didn't bother to go and vote. Whereas down in the home counties, people turn out. So they vote to leave, and they vote to leave in enormous numbers. And we've had incredible migration over the last few decades to the home counties. I won't read this out, but here you have Essex, and beneath you you've got the list of all the northern areas you have to add up together to get the same electorate as Essex, which all individually voted leave, which provides fewer leave voters than Essex, even though Essex has a smaller electorate than them. Kent, more people voted leave to Kent than the combined Derby, Blackpool, Rotherham, Sheffield, which is a huge city, Great Yarmouth, Hartlepool, Merthyr. They're more from Kent, and Kent has a smaller electorate than those. And lastly, Hampshire. I'm doing two talks in Hampshire to ask them why they did it. I don't know the point of the finger of Hampshire. Anybody from Fleet? I don't know. There you go. I know that. You can tell me later not how to go to Fleet, right? So Hampshire. More people voted to leave in Hampshire than voted to leave in Bolsover, plus Doncaster, plus Hull, plus Chester, plus Salford, plus Stoke-on-Trent, plus famously Sunderland. There are more electors in those areas. I'm offering the Royal Geographical Society the world from their following lecture, which I have prepared the slides for. But if you think this is boring, imagine you go through every county of England making this point, that in every single case I can find more Leave voters in the south, if somebody you think is affluent, than in the northern places that you... Anyway, it's obviously a problem I have, that it just annoys me. It just annoys me that we can tell the story of stupid, ignorant Welsh and Northern English people. Here's a graph over time of income inequality. So we got to a point where the best off 10th were getting 40% of all income, leaving 60% for 9 out of 10 people. Try and think of a country with 60% of the GDP of Britain, and that's what we're assigning people to. And here's just the top of the OECD lead table. There are another about 30 countries beneath which are normal. Right, they're normal. Extremely unequal countries are not normal, often in unnormal times. I grew up in the second most equal large country in Europe to Sweden. We were Scandinavian. It was called England. That was my childhood. The best 1% took only 6% of all income, only 4% after tax. A really well-paid banker would be getting £100,000 compared to the average person getting 25. Not 200, let alone a million. Just 100. And that was this country. So the most unequal is Mexico. Mexico has problems. Then Chile. Then Turkey. And boy, does Turkey have problems, which we don't talk about because Turkey has made a deal with us to keep the Syrians, and we've made a deal not to mention the fact that somebody's got his picture all over the country. And university students in the equivalent university to this are being tabled for their dormitories at night and locked up in prison. That's going on in Turkey. United States. Some interesting, nice news today. But in general, the picture's not great in the United States, I think you'd agree. Lithuania, Estonian, the Baltic states are odd. Russia, apologies for misspelling. Again, hardly a particularly functioning country. And then us. And then a slightly more equal country called Israel, where people get on slightly better with each other, and where they distribute things slightly more fairly, including in Gaza and the West Bank than we do. To get an idea of where you're living. If the OECD produced statistics for Brazil, of course Brazil will be on top of that table. It's almost too good to be true. I don't want it to be true. It's silly. At some point I'll list all the other countries. Not one of them is having a kind of muck-up that's going on in these other countries at the moment. It's not that inequality causes political madness. It's that it is a symptom of the same kind of thing. Here's just one relationship about inequality and why I sort of said about your maths. This is maths test not done at 16. People in England don't do too badly at 16. You were trained by kind of special squirrels on steroids to get those A stars in your GCSEs at 16. This is doing a maths test at 24. So think about doing a maths test in a few years from now. think, but why do I need to know maths a few years from now? I'll have my 2-1 or first from Cambridge. Nobody's going to make me do a maths test. And they weren't, and they put me in charge of a bank. we teach maths, in the USA, they teach maths the way we teach you don't learn maths or most maths. We do that not because we're completely stupid, but because in a very unequal country, your grades really matter because they determine whether you win that 10% and that 40% of everything, or whether you win the 90%, and that matters. In a normal country, that distinction doesn't matter. Schools can calm down, teachers can teach. You don't have education secretaries telling everybody you must get higher and higher marks, and you actually learn something. British Empire. How many of you were told that we were the biggest drug world in the world? That we destroyed the industry of India? That we grew opiates there and flooded the Chinese market, destroyed China? That we stole inventions from other places and called them our own spinning jennies? You can tell me later whether you were told the actual history of this country or whether you were told, oh, we were really inventive. We created great inventions and that's what made us rich. With no mention about where the magic cotton came from and how it was magically picked, or how the magic cotton pickers got it and all the rest of it. You haven't been taught your history. And it's not your fault, it's not my fault, somebody was going to be the world's biggest empire. It was us. 1 in 7 of all those carbon atoms up there are ours. Because we got to burn the coal and send it up earlier. The worldwide population boom from 1 billion to 7.5 is due more not to British soldiers raping people, which is what they thought I was saying in Stoke, but to us invading war countries. All the brown, I think, since we've invaded, I think it's 180 countries in the world, but at some point being invaded by the British. Invading more countries and disrupting more stable social societies than anybody else has ever done. Just think Australia. Think how stable Australia was before we turned up. Or China. Why do you think China got a population of 1.4 billion? What happens if you turn up a country revoking? Yeah. Oh, you may not recognise the tears. You recognise the tears. The Chancellor of my university, Chris Patton, the last colonial governor of the last colony of England, who keeps on defending the statue of Cecil Rhodes, just to keep the fight. Rubbing away his daughter's tears as she cries as the British flag sets on the last vestige of empire. I don't know, you're probably too young to know about that picture. It's a very famous picture. She wasn't crying because the flag was setting on Hong Kong. She's given an interview. She was crying because she was going to have to leave her surfer boyfriend behind. Right, of course. This is an iconic image. Even our recent history don't teach. I won't tell you how bad we are at manufacturing, and that what we manufacture is not actually high tech. I've got no time to explain that N5 2.0 ain't going to work. That India doesn't want to buy our Dyson vacuum cleaners that are made in Malaysia. And you know this, but I mean, it would be hard to make it even more laughable. And I've got no time to go through the young man, and the old fat man. And how to work out why they were so motivated. The reason I say fat is because I used to be your size for size and shape, and then to do this lecture I'd been eating a lot. So I could do this fairly. The second strongest correlate of Boat League is major immigration. The fewer immigrants, the more likely you are to Boat League. More likely you are to vote for immigrants. But the strongest correlate, the poor academic who published this about 3 weeks after the vote, was Hillary. 0.8 correlation, 0.8. The strongest correlate was obesity. So the fatter people were in there, the more likely to vote. Now it is not, I can tell you I haven't done this. I am fat, I am not lazy. Okay? This is not that machine he said. My best guess is actually partly very closely related to immigration. Those immigrants weren't just young and fit and amazingly talented and clever and hardworking. Also annoyingly thin. If you mind me. And what happens is called the epidemiology of obesity. If lots of thin people arrive in your town, or if you arrive like here in a thin town like Cambridge, you kind of eat one less burger because you feel bigger. Whereas if you live in a part of town or the country where people are fatter, you don't need a fat. So I think there's a nice little immigration connection. But also it's parts where things aren't looking good. This little graph here is a correlation of deprivation. Correlation is 0.03. Deprivation is only 0.03. If we had any more time, I'd do a poll. Things are changing over attitudes. About feeling about Britain. There are obviously many more factors at play. Standard & Poor produced this report before the vote. Remarkably prescient. Before the vote, they said the most affected country other than the UK would be Ireland, and they're spot on, and then Malta, then Luxembourg, then Cyprus. Now the key thing about that, as they are, I don't think they're negotiating in Brussels. I think they're playing some drinking game. There's nothing to do. The point about that is, those countries don't have much sway. What have the EU27 got to lose by us going? The only other country to leave the European Community was Greenland. Greenland spent 3 years negotiating because they had 56,000 people and because they had fish, a lot of fish. And Greenland was quite a good deal. They actually got citizenship of Europe through Denmark. We have a lot of fish. We've got some banks. We're about to find out a really interesting economic test of value, just how much we're worth. And it could be a bit humiliating, but it could be a great way to grow up a bit faster, rather than carrying on the kind of myth that we're in. We're odd. This graph is from the EFT, this one's from the trade unions. We're more like Greece than other countries. We're on our own when it comes to, when we finally got some bloody GDP growth, what can we do with it? Oh, the people with the money took most of it and we still make wages go down. So if you really want to annoy the population, that's the kind of thing you do. I can go on and on about health. We're the only country in Europe which has falling life expectancy. The first fall since the Second World War, the peak was 2014. Neonatal mortality in 1990. We were the seventh best. When I was born, we were really the best, seventh best in Europe. By 2015 and 2019, since that, rate of infant mortality has actually risen 2 years in a row. We had more dead babies last year than the year before, more dead babies the year before than the year before that. Nowhere else in Europe has got rising infant mortality. Things are falling apart. And if it wasn't for Brexit, this would be a national story. You know, remember the strike? Were you here for the strike last year? Completely pointless. They got the numbers wrong. There's no need to increase the contributions to the pension fund because it wasn't in deficit. It wasn't in deficit because academic life expectancy, it turns out, is not rising. Now, okay, our pension's safe. It would have helped if we had a strike, although it was fun. There was some nice dancing in Cambridge from students on YouTube. And it's not great that the academic life expectancy isn't rising, but at least the pension is solvent. What can be done? She, and only her, not her party, not her cabinet, no civil servant, nobody else but Theresa, geographies and news, 1970-something. She can walk out to the back door down the street and put the envelope through the postbox and pencil at any time up to about 10 o'clock on the 29th of March. And the other EU27 can't stop her. I don't think she will. It would make her name. It would just put Margaret Thatcher down there, wouldn't it? it would cause civil war, but you know, it's a possibility of some kind of conflict they might. Just cancel. And if possible, that is a plan. If you look at, you know, why do you send 150k document to every small business in Britain telling them you're suddenly an exporter and you've got to learn all these rules? I mean, if you were building up to a sort of desperate cancellation, this is madness. This is partly how you do it. We may not. We may get some kind of negotiation. We may crash out. Anything's possible. I tell the master students at Oxford, you're really, really lucky, because although you're paying £25,000 to do a master's, it's kind of a bit expensive, you've come in the best year ever. You've got a ringside seat. They're all from overseas. I said, you know, you're best to go home at the end of this in the summer. And you can watch it. It's like being in Berlin in 1989. It's all going to play out. Over predictions, I do not know what's going to happen, because I'm fairly sure that whatever happens, even if she cancels it now, it's going to be disastrous. Reputationally, continual battles for maybe a decade to come. People like me are going to be called traitor for maybe the rest of my life for not believing in the true sovereignty of Britain and the fact that because we've got special genes, that's why we have the empire, our genes, you may not know this. These genes were held back by this evil European community, and if you get out of that evil European community, we'll take our rightful place. And as George Osborne said in 2015, we'll be the country with the highest GDP in the world by 2030 if you follow his economic plan. And I thought he was joking, and I now begin to think actually George believed it, and it explains part of the madness we got into. But there were people who truly believed the British are destined for greatness, and that greatness is only held back by traitors and enemies. Why would we believe in the greatness and destiny of Britain? It's not unrelated to the fact that Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species at the time when the British Empire was the biggest empire in the world, and it gave the elite a story about why they were so rich. And that story's been passed down amongst various families. So I've got 2 or 3 minutes left, and then questions, so please think of a question for me. I showed you the early diagram for UKIP. I showed how the UKIP vote and there were far right voters were stoked up for elections. This is the same thing for Labour from May 2015. So May 2015, Labour won 34-33%. They kind of elect this really weird man. They're scrabbling around, doesn't help. They make him stand again, and they go and elect him again because they're taken over by Trotskyists. They have a coup. And look, he's cascading down. October 2016, January 2017, March 2017, February 2017, he's down on 26% of the vote. You're on a walking holiday, and your officials phone you up, and they say, Prime Minister, you have to call a general election, because statistically, nobody has ever not gained from this position. And you'll be wrong if you lost an election. And that advice was absolutely and completely correct. It was absolutely correct. She should have called that election. It made absolute sense. She could have established a large majority, established her authority, given that she actually hasn't won anything ever. You may not like that statement, but I can go through why the hell was she given a seat that nobody can lose as an MP? Why was there no election for her to be Prime Minister? The poor woman has never actually been given an opportunity to win anything in her life. An election would have been a chance to win something, and she lost it. That's why she should send a letter. You know, I would pay for a statue of her if she sent a letter. Anyway, I've got this nice place on the High Street in Oxford, but there's this old man called Cecil Rose that you can tell me. Both Conservatives, replacing one tour with another. Anyway, this happens. February, April, May, June. It was all the way up here, swinging at 6% a month. I've drawn 2,000 of these diagrams for every party we've got, for every poll we've ever had. Nothing like this has ever happened in British history before. The swing that occurred in the 8 weeks before the election, how many of you voted in that election? This last general election. How many of you were too young to vote? How many of you abstained? How many of you lied? Nobody ever makes a lie, I've got to find out what it is. You all voted. Somebody must have been having fun and woke up in the morning in somebody else's bed. 1 in 10 university students on Census Day, Census Day is a Sunday, 1 in 10 university students in the UK were in another city during term time on that Sunday. If you haven't done that during term, then you're making a mistake. One in ten. And you all claim not to be that one in ten, and you all got happy voted. Anyway, you're part of this, some of you. I know not all of you voted for JC, but
Jesus Christ.
Anyway, there we are, they're up to, 45% at that point, and then a little skid out. The point of showing this is there's something in the realm with voting, but we can't predict what's going to happen next, because the unpredictable just happened. So when people say, oh, this could happen at the next election, or that could happen, we've got no idea anymore. Those can't be right about experts. It's not the fault of experts. The public has started behaving in ways that they didn't behave before. Once they do that, you're useless as an expert. Because all your expertise is simply running on data and saying, this is very unlikely. Here's the swings as conventionally measured, all the elections since 1945. The 45 swing was the biggest, it was over 10 years, it involved a war, the second war we should really have had. In case any of you really liked Tony, the big swing of 1997 really wasn't a swing for Tony Blair, it was the end of 18 years of the 74, it was an anti-Tory swing. Tony Blair, when he didn't have that advantage, lost votes in 2001, he lost votes again in 2005, 5.5% really against the Blair government. Poor old Gordon Brown lost even more, it wasn't really his fault, Gordon Brown, it was that economic crash. So he's minus 6.2. I'm sure some of the older ones of you love Edwin Land, and Edwin Land's lovely. And it's really nice, you leave me to bacon sandwich to make a point. Which is a really interesting, anyway, when we eat the bacon sandwich, we're back here, forced to eat it, to show Ed bacon. It's nasty. Ed did better than Blair and Brown ever did. Ed got a 1.4% positive swing. And that's really hard for an Ed leader. Really, really good. Then the weird old local parliament speech did that. And now we're here. And it's very, very interesting. Vote Labour, no more fees, no loans, and if you adopt the policy, we're going to wipe all your loan off. There's a choice, you can vote Conservative if you want, if you like being in debt for the rest of your life. Anyway, we're weird. This is public spending as a portion of GDP. The big rises, and again, you're mainly economists, so you can do this quickly and I've run out of time. The big rises, the bailout of the banks. Ireland's very weird. We're down there, we're the red. Ireland's weird because we told them to bail out everything that's bank account. And they pulled our advice. UK, we're on, whatever it is, I think about 36% of GDP is public spending. The few other non-European countries in Ireland. That's what's possible. You can spend half your GDP on public services and be like France and Finland and live longer and have better schools and better housing. Happier people and not be trying to vote Brexit. What's going to happen to you in the next election is to move that 36 to 38. That's the most radical Labour manifesto you've ever seen in your life. 36 to 38. That's what the Labour manifesto will be. Slightly more radical than the one last time. Right? And it's completely economically irresponsible, isn't it? How can a country raise taxes and spend 38% of GDP on public services and expect not to fall apart? It's just wrong. Seriously, that's the game we're in. That's our little open window. It's late when people get us up to kind of Greece or Germany in terms of public spending. That'll take 20 years. Maybe a little faster if you ever so. We spend more on private schools than all the rest of Europe put together. We're a strange country. Getting that down is going to take a long, long time. And we don't protest. Protesting is normal in Europe. You can see the figures there, half all the French, many Spanish, Italians, Danish, even the Germans were not that into protesting. On average, have been on twice as many protests as a normal British adult. Partly because we don't protest, you can get to the point where I have an amazing number of tins of beans and have a dry goods store to make just in case. And it's not just me. Increasingly, it's always every middle class person I know in Britain, just in case. you know, maybe our amazing just-in-time supermarket system, which actually we pulled every night, is going to work. But, you know, storing some food and a few medicines and not booking any holiday after March 29th. But we'll do it quietly. We're not going to shout about it because we're British. I'm not completely pessimistic. We're very good at queuing. We really are. My personal goal is slightly ironic plan to the fatness is I think if things go really badly in the hard Brexit, we should be in ration books. But people like me should be made to queue a bit more, and it'll be one hell of a diet. You know, I have tried other diets. There's nothing like the Brexit diet. And if you're skinny, you get to eat more. We'll go from being, along with Hungary, the fattest country in Europe, to within a year, we can become the most spent country. So that's worth looking at. People migrate. They move. It's really, really good news if they come to where you are. It means you're living somewhere it's worth coming to. I won't say more about migration first. And if you don't want living standards to fall, you legislate for minimum wages and do loads of other things to say it is illegal and unacceptable for people to have living poverty or live elsewhere. And things are changing. There have been many other fires in power blocks, there have been many other disasters. This wouldn't tell you the message it tells you when you look at it if it hadn't happened at the time of that election after the Brexit vote. And the contrast of those two types of housing, the fact that you can get a monsoon lens, wouldn't have a meaning that I don't even have to say. I can remember 2005 when we were celebrating bankers making a deal, buying a bottle of champagne for £30,000 in London with a diamond worth £10,000 in it, because they're basically kissing £20,000 up against the wall. And the BBC filmed them as an example of Britain at its best, because our bankers were making such wonderful deals in 2005. And we've travelled so far, you know, just 12 or 13 years from that, to the realisation of something is deeply badly wrong and it's all going to change, and it's going to change very quickly, and we just have no idea what it's going to change to. And that's where we are now. I've got a few minutes over. Thank you for putting up with me, and please ask me difficult questions. Given the turnout of 18 or 19-year-olds, which, you know, was only about 30%, okay, maybe 16 or 17 just be a bit more excited. But on the other hand, 18-year-olds, this was the first time they're left being allowed to vote. And they didn't bother to vote. Maybe too young for the previous general election. I don't think it would have swung it. But you certainly, you know, I believe everything should begin at 16. You know, given that we're allowed to fight your country at 16, we should be allowed to do anything else. But also we should protect people up to about 21 or 24 in other ways. It should have been done. I don't think it would have swung it. I partly think, I think I had a chance to talk about Dominic Cummings and his algorithms. Dominic would have had a donation of a few more millions from some other place, and a few more million Facebook posts and Snapchat messages would have been sent in the right direction. I don't think Dominic didn't mean to win it either. He just wanted it to be really close. This is Dominic Cummings, who's in charge of the campaign, or chief executive, who's also Gove's major advisor at the Department of Education. The plan, how the Brexit thing is, was to just lose it, and then to win decisively next time. And that's why they're in such a terrible situation, because they didn't have a plan for winning.
Do you think it's fair to call the people that we call Middle England actually Middle England anymore, considering the disparity between the 1% and the 10% and everyone else?
I think you're very right. So So I went to Tewkesbury after the, Tewkesbury is a small town in Gloucester. There's a filming in Tewkesbury, and tried to spot anybody who wasn't white. And Tewkesbury is a picture postcard kind of English village, but when you go to Paris, that shows part of the majority of nature. I call it a village because I come from something bigger that's hardly huge. On the high street, it's betting shops, Poundland, and so on. The houses are bog standard, 1930, 1970, not much been done to them. Compared to houses in France and Germany, they're smaller, less well insulated, and they're worth a fortune, so nobody can start a family in Tewkesbury. And average England, out of the areas that, I can tell you, I've got the postcodes for every student that's gone to Oxford, and actually Cambridge as well. I know where you come from. But we don't come from Middle England, the vast majority of us. Those of us in this room who think we are poor come to the very top of that 9%. And that makes us unusually poor to be here. So compared to Europe, Middle England is well below average. It's struggling. It's okay for the pensioners, but their children in their 40s haven't got a pension. That means all the pension's miserable. They've got a mortgage which may go on for 40 years because they've split up and got with somebody else. And the next generation of kids now never imagined getting out of that reality. And then a median. The median is £25,000 a year. The median is always having a private landlord in future. The median is maybe being able to have a kid in your late 30s somehow. We're working out the. Even if you have a kid in private renting, the kid will still live, you'll be okay, it's just going to be a bit crap. And if you're in London, your landlord will kick you out every 3 years on average, so your child won't get to go to the same school, or keep the same friends through their childhood, as opposed to 10 years ago. And school exams also dropping like in London. So it's just crap. Our austerity is the same as Greece. Our life expectancy is lower than Greece. But we're used to this. And we have these pockets of affluence, like here. If you don't believe me, ask one of the people emptying the bins tomorrow morning, get up at 6:30, and somebody emptying one of those very large bins outside, and ask them where they commuted in from to get to Cambridge, whether it's this or whatever, and it's an hour on the train. And then go an hour on the train to Cambridge, where the people who keep this town operating live. Go and see what lives they live. But you don't have to see that. And part of England is creating these isolated bubbles for people never to see what most people are living in. I grew up in Oxford, but when I was 18 I went to Newcastle for 10 years. And that just opened up my eyes. The majority of households in Newcastle had no work. At the same time, a young man called David Cameron had done his wife out of Oxford. He never saw it. He never saw the 80s. It's partly not his fault. And he went straight from Oxford and occasionally smoking marijuana and curly bone, thinking how cool he was, to a £90,000 a year job in London. And that's what an unequal country allows you to do. It allows you not to mix in the way that other people mix. So I think it's part of the reason we met this problem. I promise the next answer will be very short.
Do you think Brexit will affect the relationship between European and non-European migrants in cities where they're in such close proximities like Sheffield, as you said?
Yes, well, I think loads is going to change. So for my mum's generation, the big thing is the Suez crisis. This is Suez times 10 or 20. I would love, if any of you could think of a way to quantify how much bigger than Suez this is. Suez was enormous. Suez was the old elite show that they were incapable. And Suez brought us the 1960s, and lots of very good things. So I'm not entirely pessimistic. I think after the next 6 years, it could be very good, just the next 6 years. No. In Sheffield, because people are already not turning up, 100,000 people haven't come, the idea that people are going to complain about the 2-month Roma, or the Somalis, or the few Eastern Europeans, or the Yemenis. I lived in Sheffield for 10 years. And every time we went to war and bombed somewhere, they turned up 3 years later. It was like clockwork. All that metric of the immigrants being a problem, I think, is going to rapidly go. Because Sheffield is incredibly lucky. You can contrast it with Liverpool. Liverpool was decimated and had the biggest population drop apart from somewhere in Eastern Germany. Had to be demolished. Glasgow, half of Glasgow over 40 years, was demolished, the population half. Sheffield, thanks to immigration, managed to carry on the same size. And so the city was very, very lucky, but never realised that immigration was saved Sheffield and kept it stable. So I'm hopeful that this is finally going to stop us blaming immigrants. Although we might blame immigrants for the fact that somebody's going to find a way of getting immigrants not coming. One in three midwives in London is the EU but not UK citizen. And we've got writing in the last half of that.
Yeah, so we're aware that there's kind of a social and locational geography to Brexit and the Brexit vote. But I was wondering if there's a geography to this kind of empire-derived identity, and if there's a geography to this mindset in global Britain, and if we've investigated that much.
No, it's a very good question. We've investigated by age. I mean, there's the strongest comment by age. And of course, we know where the old live. So 90-year-olds are incredibly concentrated on the south coast. They're so concentrated that 85-year-olds have actually step back, and they live about a mile back from the coast, because they're waiting for the 90-year-olds to die to get the CP. So there's the simple ecological by age thing. We can tell you what the probable geographical pattern of belief in empire and British is. It's different in Wales and Scotland and Ireland. Wales and Scotland and Ireland have a different idea of imperialism and empire and colonies than English. England's got a problem, particularly the home counties. I'm fairly sure, but I can't prove it, that the reason they're called home counties is their way you came home to after you served in the empire. You may not have started off there, you might have started off in Glasgow as a 20-year-old, and then you went out as an engineer to New Zealand and India. And for 40 years you built bridges and railways. And you come back to Surrey and the cottage with the roses round the window. And the home counties are what you return to. And the home counties are Brexit, and the outer home counties are Brexit central. So that's my kind of God.
Have we looked at it by income at all? It's perhaps rude.
No, I mean, identities, we do it as Englishness. We ask people how English we feel. We don't actually ask people, how proud are you of the British Empire? The people generally are, doing the kind of food surveys that are done, finds that in general people think the British Empire is a good thing, it civilised the world, it was generally beneficial, because that's what they were taught. My co-author should have said, Sally, the reason book is only half by me and half by Sally. Sally was a primary school teacher in Wolverhampton at the time of Neil Pavlov's speech, and she had to actually deal with her children crying. Sally's area of expertise is curricula, over time, what's taught in textbooks every decade. And you should see some of the textbooks that people now aged 60 or 70 or 80, what they were taught. What they were taught about the inferiority of other races, and how other races need to be governed by the white man. That was just in your geography textbook. And if you wanted a good mark at O level, you had to write it down. And part of trying to explain the attitude, it's not just the Daily Mail now, it was the school textbooks 30 or 40 years ago. And still, we are still trying to change our curricula. Yeah. I was at a meeting last week in Oxford where somebody said, look, you're flying the rainbow flag, we fly the trans flag now, we fly the suffragette flag, why aren't we flying the Black History Week flag? You know, because our history is still so shit that we are so embarrassed by the fact that we only teach a really biased form of history at Oxford. that we can't bring ourselves to fly the Black History flag because we're embarrassed. If in our universities we can't teach our history properly. Every child in China is taught about the Opium Wars. When were you taught at school about the Opium Wars? It's kind of understandable. It's hard. We teach everybody about the end of slavery and Wilberforce. When were you taught about the beginnings of slavery? Because we don't want to do that. Were you taught what we did in Kenya in the 1950s? It's tricky, isn't it? We're not used to it, so I don't get embarrassed about it. My university, I've got some, if anybody wants to do a PhD with me, it's a PhD, not really for economics. I think you can identify almost every building in Oxford. And you can trace it back to the plantation or the mine that made the money that paid for it, including some of the very oldest. Library in All Souls is the classic one. There's one ceiling that's a bit older than the Empire in the Bodleian. But otherwise, Oxford University is an Empire Trophy University. But we don't describe Oxford University as the Empire University. We describe it as Europe's oldest, repeating, 800 years. There's one ceiling that's 800 years. The rest of the thing, and it's a useful thing to have, it's great for tourists. And we're going to need them, and the pound drops. Be prepared for lots of tourists. Get plummeting. Get building funds.
I think we're going to have to end things there. Thank you so much, it's such a fascinating talk. There's a lot of things to think about before March comes around. So if you want to join us, thank you.